Science Faction is not intended for children. But just in case any are listening this episode, we'll try not to say the N-word today.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Science Faction, the only show where a scientist, a comedian, and a comedian scientist come together to discuss science comedically.
Hello, and welcome to Science Faction 282, Science Faction, the origin of mammals.
The most cuddly of all the branches of life.
That's true, actually, it is, because they have the fur and whatnot.
Well, I am a scientist.
Yeah.
Well, keep going. Proceed with the show. Let's not stop here.
Dick joke scientist?
I'll take it.
You're DJ scientist.
Dick joke scientist, DJ scientist sounds like an MIT undergrad who's experimenting and disappointing his father.
Yeah, and with house music. Indeed, we have done our Origins of series, our new intro bit. We talked about the origins of the universe. We talked about the origins of the solar system and stars and planets and the Earth and life itself. Last week, we covered multicellular life. And now it seems about time that we should cover the mammals. So we, of course, are mammals. It brings up the question, what are mammals? Can you guys think of what constitutes a mammal?
They be slinging warm blood. They be slinging live young. They be slinging, in the exception of monotremes, of course, like the echidna and another breed of echidna, I believe, and the platypus. And anything else? Oh, they be squirting milk at their nipples.
Oh, man, that's great, DJ Scientist. Way to go. Really dropping the beat.
I keep science fresh, yo.
No, that's actually pretty good. You know, they have fur or hair. They feed milk to their young. They are endothermic, meaning they provide their own internal body heat. And
they do not have cloacas. They have
genitals
that are more similar to what I am packing.
That's true. Cloaca, like birds and reptiles, essentially have a single hole where everything comes out at the bottom. We have split out into different holes, except for occasionally when Damien gets a hold of a small mammal and then makes it one hole again. He devolves them back into reptiles. And then, as you mentioned, with the exception of the monotremes, they give birth to live young. So that's what a mammal is. And you might think, oh man, what a great epitome of evolution. We have come to this mammal thing. And the fact is, it's not like mammals are better than other creatures. We do certain things better, but it all depends on what you can or can't do to survive. And the great example of that lies in the history of mammals. So we see mammals start coming into the fossil record almost at the same time we see dinosaurs, about 200 million years ago.
I have heard you many times shit on the marsupial, saying that it is inferior to the mammal. Is it?
No, marsupial is a mammal.
No, I get it. So it's because it's mammal on mammal crime.
Right.
You're just going to dismiss that.
Yes. Yes. I'm a black guy who gets to use the N-word.
That's a mammal.
The M-word.
That's R-word.
So we see the mammals pop into the fossil record around that time. Here's a good question for you guys, because we just talked about what makes a mammal. How do you think we can tell a mammal in the fossil record? Because we can't see the soft tissue, right? We can't see the mammary glands. We can't see the fur. We can't see all this stuff. How do we tell?
I know the ear bones are unique to
exactly.
The mammals.
Exactly. Perfect. So we have basically equipped these two bones that in other animals are actually part of the jaw. So in reptiles and other animals, these bones, which are the smallest ones in the human body, they're part of the jaw itself. In mammals, they've evolved to be part of the hearing process, which is one of the reasons mammals tend to have the best hearing. They have this incus malleus stapes in the ear. And so if we find those bones, we know we're looking at mammals.
Another unique aspect of mammals is the neocortex. That region of the brain just doesn't exist in other creatures. And there are sort of similar structures, like in birds, that display levels of intelligence. But the neocortex probably helped us colonize the planet and take over.
And it's the front part of your brain. It allows us to develop much more complex behaviors, social activities. And it's also the reason that your pet snake will never really love you. Like, that thing is just waiting to be big enough to eat you. It doesn't give a fuck about you. All the social elements, all that stuff comes from that place in the neocortex. That's true. But as you probably know, it can sometimes be hard to determine brain specificities from endocasts, especially if you don't have the full skull. So we can't always tell what the brain structure is like on a lot of fossils. So you're right, absolutely, with the ear bones thing. So we see about 200 million years ago, we see these animals pop into existence, again, around the same time as dinosaurs. Those were our competing brothers in arms, so to speak.
Are you saying that a dinosaur could never love me either?
Dinosaurs would be interesting.
Just wham, bam, thank you, ma'am.
Yeah.
Get out of here, get out of my bedroom.
You know, dinosaurs, if you want to talk about it literally, are birds now. So, you know, maybe, I don't know. I kind of feel like birds are pretty primal and probably wouldn't actually love you either. But who knows? They do live in more social groups and they do have, as Dr. Troy mentioned, different type of brain that has some more advanced features. I don't think they will actually love you, those dinosaurs.
We're in the Jurassic Park universe where raptors are smarter than people, apparently. can that raptor love me? Or is it just a is it just a biologically different brain using yeah. what you know of science fiction?
No, it's never going to love you. It's never going to make sweet art. There will never be a DJ scientist of the raptor world.
It loves hunting you.
Yes, that's true. So we see it around 200 million years ago, pops into existence, evolves along with the dinosaurs. But when we see this age of dinosaurs, arguably starting around 200 million years ago, though it doesn't take off until a little bit after that, when you see this age of dinosaurs come out, you see dinosaurs come and radiate into all these different positions, take in all these different niches throughout the world. And mammals basically remain these small, very small, usually nocturnal creatures that don't change a whole lot and don't fill a lot of niches. They're basically scavengers. They come out when the dinosaurs go to sleep. They eat whatever they leave behind. They hurry back to their burrows and they hope they don't get eaten. That's the best case scenario for a mammal for literally 140 million years. For the bulk of mammals' existence on the face of this earth, we were the world's bitch.
But we bided our time.
We did.
Hired an asteroid to come clean house.
Right.
We Game of Thrones this planet.
We were like the kid in high school who's constantly picked on everything, but he just knows it doesn't matter. When I'm a plastic surgeon in 10 years, I'm going to get all the poon.
Slaying pee.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that is essentially what these mammals were. And then what happens is you have these dinosaurs radiate into all these niches. They fill everything. They are the dominant creature on the face of the earth. And then this big asteroid comes, hits off the Yucatan, blocks out the sun for a long time. What does that do? It kills off, obviously, everything in the radius, the heat radius, you know, a couple hundred miles. But then it also blocks out the sun enough that it kills off the plants, which kill the plant eaters. And then there's no meat eaters left. So all these things are dying over time. The sun could have been blocked for a few years from what we know, and at least some amount of it was for a certain amount of time. But what survives? The nocturnal thing that's a scavenger. Because now all of a sudden there's a whole bunch of meat lying around and it can run out and it's dark. It doesn't care. It loves the dark. It runs out. It's got good night vision. It can eat this stuff. It's small. It doesn't require a lot of energy input. Even better is that thing we mentioned about mammals. They're endothermic. So it doesn't need to heat itself up from the sunlight. It doesn't die right away just because it can't heat itself up. As long as it can process enough food, it can keep its own heat from the interior. Basically, mammals were this weird little niche thing that existed for a while, but its little niche just happened to be exactly what was needed to survive a cataclysm like an extraterrestrial impact.
Small, efficient engines.
Yeah. We were the Japanese of animals. So mammals survived. And then what happened? The dust settles quite literally from the extraterrestrial impact. A couple years down the road, all of a sudden, what's running around? All these mammals. They're actually doing really well. They survive. There's nothing hunting them. What happens when nothing is hunting you? You start expanding, expanding. And all of a sudden, you have a radiation now, instead of dinosaurs into all these niches, of mammals filling all these niches. And it goes from not just these little ground-dwelling things. They get bigger and bigger. They have a lot of different adaptations, from quadruped to bipedal. Not even just in us, but things like kangaroos and stuff like that. And then you have them radiate into the sky as bats and into the water as cetaceans and pinnipeds. You have this massive expansion. And we begin the age of mammals 65 million years ago, thanks to our friend, that asteroid who took out those dinosaurs.
He was our big friend. Hey, come yeah. kill this bully.
Exactly.
And not just the asteroid, but any sort of event that clears out a niche. So all sorts of catastrophes, climate mm-hmm. changes, just over the entire history of Earth has led to this, you know, increasing
yep.
and successive sweeps of various things. And if that hadn't happened in precisely the way it did, we likely wouldn't have ended up even having those tiny yeah. little ancestors that could spread.
We absolutely wouldn't, right? Because we know it because we had 140 million years of previous research showing that, you know, nothing happens when these mammals are being held down by the dinos.
So much of filling a new niche is really the first to get in there.
Yeah.
Like flight, powered flight that's not insects has only evolved three separate times in the history of Earth that we know of. And one was pterosaurs. They actually beat the dinosaurs to it. And then dinosaurs got it with birds much later. Bats were the last ones. And so that was actually the one niche where there were still dinosaurs competing with us. Mm-hmm. And so that's why bats got relegated to being nocturnal, because birds had already sort of taken over all the daytime niches and filled right. the skies. And so that was the only way they could sort of slip in there still.
And we don't even need to look at the history of the world. We had this in the Cambrian explosion that we talked about the other week. It's not just that. We see this happen on an individual basis. If you get a bunch of antibiotics and clear out your microbiome, we see it get colonized, not necessarily by the best bacteria, but the ones that happen to be there. The ones that happen to be in DJ Science's semen.
Okay, I'm going to take a step back here. You mentioned before that the fictional raptor couldn't love me, but the very real-life octopus is a very intelligent animal.
Right.
Doesn't have a cerebral cortex.
And it won't love you either.
It won't love me either?
No.
Well, then Japanese cartoons have lied to me for years.
And those aren't cartoons. I've seen, that's real live action.
I've dressed up like a schoolgirl and gone to SeaWorld several times. Let me just say, left very disappointed.
But think about that. Think about what that means. Now, the other thing is, when we think of mammals nowadays, we actually get a skewed perspective because you think of dogs and cats and maybe a cow and a horse. You forget that up until 10,000 years ago, mammals filled way more niches, especially big mammals, mammoths, mastodons, giant ground sloths, bears, everything. We had these giant animals running around. Mammals really became the dinosaurs of our time. You know, they weren't just small things that were smaller than us. They were gigantic creatures that spanned all around the earth, and they went into all these weird little specific niches. I mean, on every continent. If you go down to Antarctica, there's one of the scariest mammals on earth. The leopard seal is down there in an aquatic environment, getting up on sheets of ice to go get penguins. And then, you know, you go into the tropics and you'll find a fruit bat that comes out that's the size of a fucking dog. It's called a flying fox. And it will come out in the middle of the night and just literally eat tons and tons of specific fruit. We have gone into these...
One bat will eat tons of a specific fruit?
We have gone into these insanely specific niches. Everything from, you know, a giraffe with its super long neck to elephants to all the stuff that is now extinct that was really, really interesting to, you know, there were a lot of relatives of like rhinos and stuff like that that were running around at the time. There is just so much in this huge biological radiation, and it went so far. And unfortunately, we don't really see the remains of that as much right now, unless you're in a place like Africa on the Serengeti. But mammals basically dominated the world over the last 65 million years only because of that one asteroid.
I think if an asteroid hit the Earth again, I feel, Bobby, you'd be at an advantage. Because while you're not nocturnal, the sun is very damaging to you.
That's true. A code of I don't need it. World. I can make my vitamin D on my own.
You thrive.
And speaking of vitamin D, I, of course, am your host, comedian archaeologist Robert Timothy. And with me, as always, my comedian, Mr. Damian Mercado. Damian, how are you doing this afternoon?
Doing fine, but I believe we were calling me DJ Science.
That is right. DJ Science and his microbiome-seeding semen. And someone who doesn't need any microbiome-seeding of his own, our scientist for the afternoon, Dr. Troy. Dr. Troy, how are you doing?
Good. It's always fun to be on. I hope I can live up to the guy who was on last week.
Yeah, that guy was awesome. Yeah, yeah. Welcome back 2 weeks in a row. And if you want to check out either last week's episode or any of the articles we covered last week or this week, you can check that out at our website, www.thesciencefaction.com. And, you know, we don't do this. We're not one of the podcasts who does, like, listener shout-outs. I always hate that when the first half hour of a podcast is somebody yelling about who donated to their Patreon.
But we finally have a listener.
No,
so,
but...
like, we got to celebrate this.
But I'll tell you this. Every once in a while, I just see the same listeners really carrying a lot of the weight. And I saw one guy who was just... he liked probably half a dozen of our episodes and the show itself and everything. So shout-out to Matt Green, if you're out there. We see what you're doing. We appreciate you. Thanks for being a good listener. You're awesome. No one else expect to get this. This is a Matt Green exclusive.
I'm sorry, Joel Riggins, a regular person who interacts with our Twitter account and says nothing but nice things. I wanted to give you a shout out here on this podcast. I know you would have loved it, but Bobby said I can't.
Is that actually a guy's name?
Yeah, well, I'll pull up the fucking Twitter account right now. I don't know if it's his Twitter handle. I don't know if it's a real fucking name.
Riga what?
I think he might be British, or I might be thinking of another
okay,
one.
All right.
So thank you, mate. Australia down in.
All right, let's get right on to science articles.
From molecules to particles, this is Science Articles.
Article number one, does getting sick as a child make you crazy?
Who's giving syphilis to kids?
That would make you crazy, right? It would take a while, though. I think it would wait till you get older.
It's a slow burn.
Yeah. This is really interesting. First off, Bio, before we actually talk about the article itself, I should warn you, in case you go to our website to go look at the original article.
This following article involves children getting syphilis.
No, it does not. But it is published in a journal called iPsych, lowercase I, capital letter psych. So it sounds like a Macintosh-based pranking program. Like,
so just,
psych!
Did Jobs found this magazine?
Yeah, I don't know what they're doing with that. But regardless, it was cross-published in JAMA, so I'll give it to them. So the story focuses on how infections or possibly the treatments to infections affect children. We've had some evidence for some time that there are certain infections that seem to indicate or seem to precede mental illness in adults. And so they were wondering if this is true in kids, and a lot of times what we see is this is more true in children than it would be in adults, so they wanted to look at a childhood population. Now, you can't just go around getting a bunch of kids sick to see if they go crazy afterwards. It's slightly unethical.
Thanks, Obama.
Right, and in the U.S., we have HIPAA laws that are very restrictive as to what you can do with medical information of the general public. However, if you go to a place like Denmark, not only do they not have those laws, but because of socialized medicine, all of that info is in one place. You don't have to go to 1,000 different private healthcare individuals or doctors or whatever to get it. You just go to their...
To the Department of Making Children Ill.
Yes. To the baby syphilis program.
Jesus. Do they recruit sex offenders just straight out? Like, how does it work in this? I've never been to Denmark. You have.
Under the incredibly controversial Tuskegee crib experiments...
That was a better route to take.
What they did is they looked at the data, and they looked at kids between 95 and 2012, and they looked at kids who had gone in for serious infections into the hospitals and had treatment, and then whether or not they then had to be treated for a mental disorder afterwards, specifically very close to that particular infection. And what they found was that high temperatures, sore throats, and infections during childhood can increase the risk of also suffering from a mental disorder as a child or an adolescent. Now, we don't know if, when we say can increase the risk, if that's actually causational or correlational. We're just saying it is associated with that. So this is the first of its kind study, and it follows those kids born between January 1st, 95 and June 30th, 2012. The study showed that children who had been hospitalized with an infection had an 84% increased risk of suffering a mental disorder and a 42% increased risk of being prescribed medicine to treat the mental disorder. But that's overall. What was actually more shocking was the more immediate results. The risk of mental disorders were highest right after the infection, pointing to a strong combination between the two of those. I'm going to give you guys a chance to guess this. How much higher do you think the chance of getting a mental disorder was within 3 months of a serious infection for a child in Denmark between those times?
We're talking kids developing bipolar disorder.
It's mainly seems to highly impact schizophrenia-type disorders, but it was looking at a range of mental disorders as well.
What I want to do is I want to wait for Troy to guess. Then I want to try to price his right.
Yeah, go $1 over.
So I'm going to say $1.
Okay.
I'm
going to free... That's not even a currency.
$1, sir.
Fair enough. Troy, how many times more do you think it was?
I would say maybe 300% because if the lifetime is 80%,
right,
that and it sort of trails off with time.
Right.
So.
Good logic. It's even higher, 5.6 times higher in the first 3 months and 2 times higher within the first year. So that's significant. Like, that is not a, hey, we're seeing a 0.08 and it's near our margin of error or something like that. This is very significant.
I have a theory. I don't know if it's a causation correlation thing. I'm going to run it by you. Tell me what you two scientists think. Kids who get sick more possibly weren't vaccinated. Those kids are going to be crazier because they grew up inside of an anti-vaxxer's house.
Right.
It's a stupider, crazier environment.
Interesting correlational connection.
So these are the kids who, of course, are going to catch the measles. And, of course, they're going to be crazier than the people who didn't catch the measles.
Interesting.
In studies nowadays, it's common practice to control for anti-vaxxers and flat earthers because that really skews the data.
Get them out of there. So there are some interesting questions because this is a very, very big number. This is a huge effect. I mean, when you see a 5.6 time effect over that time period, especially when it is, you know, we have this idea called dose dependent in medicine, where if you're exposed to something and you want to show it's causational and not correlational, the effect, so if you get more of the dose, a higher dose, you have a bigger effect, that's good evidence. This is kind of that same idea because you see that 5.6 number in the first 3 months, it dwindles down to 2 times within the first year and then 84% over the lifetime of the individual. So that's kind of dose dependent in terms of the closer you are to the thing, the more likely you are to have it. Now, we have a lot of questions. What could be causing this? There are quite a bit of possible ideas that we have that we don't know yet. Number one, could it be that an infection gets into the brain and then therefore does some damage? We know that is possible. Not only is that possible in cases like meningitis, we've been finding more and more that things like herpes get past the blood-brain barrier. And when they do that, they might increase your chance of something like Alzheimer's. We talked about that a few weeks ago. So could it be that these kids are getting an infection and that particular infection is somehow warping or damaging their brain? Possible.
You're saying their brains with herpes sores on them?
Yes, absolutely. That is almost certainly how it works.
That's what a nightmare looks like.
Yeah, you got to take some Abreva on the tip of your pinky and just jam it into your ear. Try and rub your brain as much as possible.
I snort Valtrex.
So that's one thing, right? too, we've talked before about autoimmune disorders. We know that if you basically trigger your immune system, it can go after parts of your own body. That happens in Crohn's disease, it happens in arthritis, happens in Lyme disease, happens in a lot of cases, right? Maybe some of these infections are training the immune system of these kids to go after parts of their brain. And so what we're seeing is an autoimmune reaction to a specific disease. Maybe because we're looking at hospitalizations and medications, some of the medications are the problem. For instance, maybe the medication itself is neurotoxic, and we didn't know that until we saw these big studies, and it only affects kids in a certain way. Or maybe the medication, like an antibiotic, is clearing out parts of the gut microbiome that are very helpful. And as we talked about just a few minutes ago, gut microbiome is very important to your health. Maybe that ends up damaging you in a way that affects your mental health. Maybe it's not even biological. Maybe this is a social issue. Maybe when you take a young child and put them in a hospital-type setting for a few weeks or whatever it is for a serious infection, it can precipitate something that's already lurking in them and bring out schizophrenic-type behaviors.
So that's definitely an explanation, a possible one. I think a cool thing about this study, though, was they had access to patient data that didn't involve any hospitalization.
Yes.
They just got like home prescriptions.
Right, outpatient.
Yeah, and so that eliminates a lot of concerns,
yes,
like maybe they, you know, got exposed to things in the hospital or it
right
was stressful.
Or the social aspect, if they're, I mean, you could argue even being sick at home might still have some kind of social implication, but it would be hard to say that it's the same as being sequestered in a hospital.
Yeah, and the people who weren't actually hospitalized, the end results of their increased likelihood for mental disabilities was like half of what it was
yeah
due to hospitalizations. And that could be due to a hospital-specific effect, or it could just be they were less severe because,
yeah,
because they didn't have to be hospitalized.
By definition, you weren't hospitalized because you weren't as bad as the ones who were. And also, there are certain antibiotics that you only get through IV in a hospital. So if there is a difference between a doctor handing you a prescription for antibiotics and you going into a hospital and getting certain IV antibiotics, it might be, again, an antibiotic-dependent thing and you're just getting stronger stuff in the hospital.
It was also really interesting how only the people who were prescribed the antibiotics and not, or the anti-infection drugs in
mm-hmm
general and not hospitalized, only the antibiotics were the ones that had an associated mental impact.
Right.
And so antivirals, things
yes
like that did not. And so that implies there is a microbiome component to it.
It does, but it also might not. And here is why. Antibiotics are widely prescribed through unknown infections too. So a lot of times if you have a bad infection, a doctor, especially in places like this where it's not money dependent because it's public healthcare, a doctor isn't always going to wait to get your biopsies or your tests back. And so one of the things that they were saying and the confounding factors is a lot of the kids getting these antibiotics might not even have had bacterial infections. When they did the breakdown, the kids going into the hospital or going through outpatient treatment for severe infections, the percentage of them getting antibiotics was almost the whole sample size. So you're right when they compared with the antivirals and stuff, but those were really specific outliers. The results might be tainted by the fact that we've essentially painted almost the entire brush of these infected kids with antibiotics, even the ones that didn't necessarily have bacterial infections.
Also, when you consider they're counting any sort of infection and any sort of mental thing,
mm-hmm,
you know, I'm sure there are a lot of potential different causes having different effects with
yeah
these different mental outcomes, and it's just a sort of mishmash of everything.
And we know things like schizophrenia, at least some portions of it, are genetically dependent, right? So we might not be saying these things are causing this. It might be a situation like, we've talked about this before, certain drugs, hallucinogens, even sometimes cannabis, can bring out schizophrenia in patients. And so for a while, the medical community literally said, hey, LSD causes schizophrenia. Well, more research came out and they said, well, what's most likely happening is these people are schizophrenic. They're going to show symptoms sometime soon. This drug accelerated the outbreak of those symptoms. They would have been schizophrenic anyway, but it happened. Maybe that's the case with them as well. Maybe this is the same type of thing. These kids would have grown up to be schizophrenic, would have grown up to have these mental problems, but the specific illness weakened them to the point where those things came to the surface sooner than they would have otherwise.
And in fact, when they controlled for the siblings of the children
yeah
they were testing, the effect did lessen. It didn't go away completely,
yep,
but that also implies there's likely some sort of genetic impact or component as well.
Exactly.
Going back to your hospital point, it doesn't surprise me at all that kids who stayed in the Denmark hospital had higher rates of, because I believe I read somewhere that as a cost-cutting measure, Denmark actually has combined their children's hospital and their mental health hospital. And I imagine it's very difficult to recover from your surgery with a guy dressed as Napoleon, another guy with a constant erection, and a big Indian guy throwing fountains through windows.
So what you're imagining is some kind of sitcom where they decided to put kids and mental patients in the same hospital just to see what happens, I guess. And then they form some sort of Lord of the Flies type society where they convalesce together.
Oh, you think the kids took charge? You think the kids weren't a currency in this prison? I'm sorry to burst your bubble, Bobby. It's more like Oz than it is.
No wonder all these kids are getting syphilis.
I believe they call their hospital the Department of Childhood Syphilis from earlier.
Now, what's nice about this study is not only do we have all this data, not only do we have a huge N number, not only do we have longitudinal studies of their ongoing health, both mental and physical health, but one of the great things about a place like Denmark is with a public healthcare system, you kind of pull the cost out of the issue. So if I see a study like this in the United States, I'm already thinking, well, yeah, but who can afford to take their kid to the hospital? It's the same person who can later afford to take their kid to mental health care professionals when they're sick. That can be a confounding factor. Whereas when you go to a place like Denmark where that stuff is free to you, that takes away a huge part of that barrier. And it means that you're looking more at the broad population as opposed to just those who can afford medical care. So just from where this study comes from, it gives it more scientific validity.
Shouldn't we have a lot better data on how healthy rich kids are in this country
then?
Yes,
we do.
Oh, okay.
I mean, if you look at technically all that data that we have, except for the ones that have to do with free clinics or something like that, you are looking at a subset of the population. You are looking at those who can afford to go to a hospital. You are looking at the ones whose parents cared enough to take them to a hospital. And if you think that, oh, yeah, who wouldn't care enough to take them to a hospital? That exists, and it's a big portion of our population when you look at it as the down payment on a house to take your kid to the hospital.
Yes, I've met your father.
Yeah, these Scandinavian healthcare data sets are just so great because they're huge and they're unbiased, and they really let us answer questions that we wouldn't be able to otherwise. And this was, in fact, something they specifically set out to do, where there was a thought in the past that severe infections could lead to mental health issues. And so they went about looking for this, but I'm really excited for the kind of things we can do once we can just like let machine learning algorithms loose on all this data.
Yes.
And then they'll just pull out weird salient features like,
right,
hey, anybody who scraped their knee when they were a kid in this environment got this weird toxin that led to something else. And
I'll tell you what, the one that I think is going to be a big deal and something that people aren't talking about enough. If we had a predictive test for something like psychopathology, we would totally change our society. There's an estimate that it's something like 60 to 85% of all the people in jail for violent crimes are some form of psychopath in our society, even though psychopaths make up about 1% of the society as a whole. They also cause a whole lot of problems. They're 100% of the serial killers. There are huge portions of violence that are going on that are unpunished, so they're not in jail. There are a huge part of problems with corporate entities. If you could identify psychopaths from an early age, you would be able to create a utopian society because you take out the bad element of that society. So if you had machine learning that can look back and say, okay, we have these people's medical records from the time they were born until now. And now at age 25, we realize this kid's a psychopath. He's a serial killer. He's done this, this, and this. We can now go back and start looking at it and going, okay, what are the signs? What are the things? Like, we already have some stuff we know psychologically, things like starting fires, abusing animals, wetting the bed. That can indicate those psychopaths. But what if we can go back and be like, oh, now we figured it out. Do this quick retinal scan on a four-year-old and you'll be able to tell. That will change society drastically.
Are you suggesting science that would eventually lead to a Minority Report-esque system that prevents assholes from being born?
Yes. At least we'll do with them what they did with like the Spartan kids where like this one's fucked up, just leave him out in the wild.
Don't empathize with this child. He wouldn't empathize with you.
Yeah. I mean, listen, knowing who is and is not a psychopath would be probably one of the greatest advantages any single society can have. Because it doesn't matter how much technology you have. It doesn't matter how much advancement you have, how wealthy you are. When you have negative actors that are out there doing things for the purpose of harming others because that is their intention, that's a whole different ballgame. Anybody can kill someone. You can be pushed into a corner. You can get mad enough.
Watch.
Anybody can do it. But that's a very different system than somebody who takes pleasure and whose main motivation and goals is to harm other people and harm society in general. That type of antisocial personality disorder, that makes up a gigantic portion of our overall societal problems. And if you could take out that 1% or I don't know, even take them to a special place and treat them from a young age. That 1%, just know that they're there, know who they are, have them identified. You would live in a fucking utopia. Even with all the other problems, nothing would compare. The legal justice system would have to be completely reworked because there'd be almost nobody in prison. You would be able to leave your fucking car doors unlocked. People would be able to walk around at night in the dark without worrying about being murdered.
This is America. We'll find a way to lock people up.
Yeah,
it's not all psychopaths who are in jail.
Yeah, I mean, at least with the violent stuff. But just things like that. I agree with you, Dr. Troy. I think when we start looking at these large data sets in terms of being able to use them for predictive modeling, to be able to tell the precursors of disease, I mean, when you look at certain diseases that get worse over time but can be treated much better, autism is a great example. You start treating autism at 1 to 2 years old, and those kids who would otherwise be labeled as severe autist can be medium autistic. You know, like, they're not nearly as bad. You treat from a young age and you can cure a lot of those problems, but you don't diagnose autism that young. So what if you can? Because what if you look at these big data sets and realize, oh yeah, remember when we took the blood tests from these kids and they had higher levels of iron or whatever it is? That looks like that's a warning sign. We should use this later on.
I bet China's going to be at the forefront of this because they're all about that government surveillance of everybody, and they have huge data sets. And
they do, but they have a big problem that Denmark doesn't have, which is similar to us. They have a system that is very wealth dependent. Your average Chinese peasant does not have access to hospitals, whereas you could literally be a homeless person in Denmark and walk right into a hospital.
That's true. There's always some sort of bias. And in China, it's that. And even, you know, when you think of Denmark and what a great data set it is, you also have to consider that they're very genetically similar to one another, and it doesn't necessarily extend to other
people. I was about to get that. They're very homogeneous. So that means that this particular thing that we're seeing might not be a phenomenon in human beings. It might be a phenomenon in Danish people, right? Because that is a very narrow genetic scope. You're talking about...
I mean, we all remember hearing the jokes, like, if you get a Dane sick, he'll be fucking crazy with it.
Yeah. Well, it could be that this is just a quirk of their particular thing. What if it's just a quirk of their society? That would be even weirder, right? Like, what if there's a weird thing in Danish society that none of us are aware of, where there's some stigma against people who get very sick, and so you do that, and then your kids bully you, and then that leads to mental... What if? You know, who knows? We won't know until we have bigger numbers. However, based on some of the indications that Dr. Troy mentioned, including the fact that it has some kind of correlation with the amount of antibiotics you get prescribed and whether or not you're inpatient, outpatient, I would tend to think it is a biological component. And I would tend to think that without outside evidence, I'll go with the null hypothesis and say there's nothing specific about the Danish people that make them unique to this thing, and therefore it probably applies to people in general. Now, this brings up another question, which is, should parents be even more concerned about their kids getting illnesses? You know, if we see that we have a very negative situation, schizophrenia, it's hard to get more negative than schizophrenia without your kid actually dying.
Has ever been a case of schizophrenia being a positive? Like, for example, your imaginary friend is fucking awesome and helps you. It's Warren Buffett, like a funny, sexy
Ryan Gosling. He gets lots of really good advice. You know, you can't say for sure, but I'll say this. Maybe there'll be a time at some point where a schizophrenic guy was randomly around somebody who would have been very dangerous to him, let's say a psychopath, and that psychopath was about to do something, but that schizophrenic was so crazy, he just stabbed him first.
Took back the knife.
Yeah. Took back the crazy. So maybe that happened. But usually, no. Usually, schizophrenia is all bad for you and even arguably worse for your family, who then have to deal with all the other consequences. So does this mean parents should be even more concerned than they already are about their kid getting sick? I think it should be certainly more concerned about giving your kid antibiotics. I've run into this. We had a misdiagnosis with my son where somebody had done the test wrong at Rady's Children's Hospital, one of the best children's hospitals in the world. And they said, hey, he's got this bacterial infection. We need to give him antibiotics. I knew he didn't from some confounding factors. He had had another infection that was healing. As I explained to the physician over and over again, there's never a case in medical literature in the history that I can find in which one infection is being healed by your body while the other same bacterial infection is killing you. And she gave me the yeah, but we need to give it to him. Made us sit in the hospital. They were literally hooking him up for the IV, and I didn't let them give him the antibiotics. He later tested negative because, as I was correct in my assumption, he did not have this bacterial infection. But if they would have given him a high dose of incredibly strong antibiotics at like 6 months old intravenously for no reason. And I do think that while there's a lot of problems with parents trying to dictate the care to their kids when doctors are the experts, there should be some healthy skepticism for antibiotics that have not made their way into the medical community yet. And you as parents kind of have to be your kid's advocate. If your kid's not going to die from it, if they're not risking losing something, if it's just he's sick and we need to get him better, if you can avoid those antibiotics at any cost, this isn't like anti-vaxxing. This is something that has some legitimate medical backing and something you should be concerned about.
Bobby's right. Antibiotics cause autism.
God damn it.
You're the new Andrew Wakefield, Bobby.
But yeah, you think about that. I mean, this may be something where you, if you are a parent, should think about advocating for your kid when they are in the hospital to the extent that is reasonable and that you're not impairing their health or other issues for not getting antibiotics if they don't absolutely need them. All right, article number two, amazing mitochondrial surprise.
Is it like surprising your science-hating grandfather with like a DNA test? Like one of those 23andMe? Like, thought I was getting a fishing boat. Oh, awesome.
Turns out grandma cheated on you.
Yeah. Oh, I get to find out I'm 1% black. Yay, this is going to do well for my Trump-loving ass.
So we've talked about mitochondria before. And by the way, this study that I am about to bring up, this is a huge study. I mentioned it briefly last week. I actually got a few tweets. Why didn't you talk about this? The reason was because all the data hadn't come out by the time we recorded. And so I didn't want to spoil this without doing some in-depth research and figuring it out. Those guys who follow our show for a while know about mitochondria, basically the powerhouse of the cell. Because it has its own DNA, we only inherit it directly from our mothers. It has basically nothing to do with our nuclear DNA. It is not what makes us us. It's just what powers our cell. Everybody gets it directly from your mother because, whether you're a man or a woman, because when fertilization happens, when the egg meets the sperm of humans and of most animals actually has the mitochondria in it. So the man's mitochondria is in the sperm. Once the sperm makes contact with the egg and starts burrowing in, it detaches the tail, which is how it moves, and the tail flies off with the mitochondria in it, and no mitochondria from the man ends up getting into the woman.
Real question. How much effect does mitochondrial DNA have on phenotype if it's just...
It can, in the case of diseases. So bad mitochondria can lead to mitochondrial diseases. You have some kind of mitochondria that's not efficiently producing energy. Sometimes, in fact, they think most of the time, that just means the child never develops. Most fertilized eggs never become babies. Most of them end up dying and being flushed out of the womb.
I believe you've referred to God as the biggest abortionist.
Yes, God loves abortions. That's the proof enough because the vast majority of fertilized eggs never see the light of day.
Unless you're Irish, in the case everyone's yeah. fucking hit.
So people with mitochondrial disease, that's part of it too. But then people are born with mitochondrial diseases and they'll need treatment for them because they have some kind of gene depletion or something. So that's been the story for the longest time. Well, just last week, an article got published in which a person was found to have inherited some, not all, some of her mitochondrial DNA from her father. Now, she came to a mitochondrial specialist because of that. She literally went to the Mayo Clinic and she was having problems and there's an issue. He's a mitochondrial specialist. He looked at her mitochondria and realized this woman has two...
Spit out his coffee.
She has two different mitochondria. So this is a really, really weird thing. So she has one from her mom and then they're like, what the fuck is this? They thought it was some kind of test mistake, basically, and he couldn't figure it out.
She has two power plants on site.
Yes.
Well, actually, you only have two copies of your chromosome in your cells, but you have thousands of mitochondria. So you yes. actually have a lot of copies in each of your cells. And so you can have a mix of, you know, part mom, part dad is what we're finding.
Right. Well, not usually, right? Yeah. So usually it still works the same way. This is a very unique case. They found this woman and they looked at it and they couldn't figure out how in the world this is happening. They had to test her three or four different times to realize that this was actually
Mind
the case.
Mind if I take a stab at it before you sure. say it to the audience? Now, if we remember from the history of mitochondria, mitochondria is there because it was a separate organism
right.
that was absorbed
yep.
Within the cell.
Yep.
What I'm saying is the mitochondria, tired of being eaten, decided to do some eating of itself and ate a gamete.
Okay.
A Y chromosome gamete.
That makes no sense. couldn't work in any kind of fashion.
I'm a dick scientist. Yeah. You're not going to give me this. I've done research. Troy, you want to jump in and tell me how dumb I am?
Yeah, that would be impressive for it to eat a Y chromosome much larger than itself.
They started looking around and they actually found 17 people in three different families who had inherited 24% to 76% of their mitochondria from their father. We're still not sure the mechanism of this. There's a couple of theories on this. maybe the fathers have a weird genetic defect where their sperm does not detach the tail when it fertilizes the egg and therefore takes the mitochondria in with it. Maybe it's the other way. Maybe it's actually on the mother's side where the mother's eggs have a weird thing where they absorb the tails of the sperm before it's able to get in. Regardless, this is very, very interesting. And it's interesting for bigger reasons than just mitochondrial disease, which is its own thing. And it's something that is a very big deal. Here's why it's interesting from my perspective, from physical anthropology, archaeology, and genetics. We use mitochondria as a genetic clock. We have two of these. We have mitochondria DNA and Y chromosome DNA. And the reason we use this is unlike your nuclear DNA, which makes you you, your Y chromosome DNA you get
runs
directly
on Greenwich Mean Time.
Yeah. We thought you got the mitochondrial DNA directly from your mom all the time, and you definitely get your Y chromosome directly from your father all the time. What that means is that doesn't have recombination. Your nuclear DNA is a recombination of your mom's DNA and your dad's DNA. That means we don't know what switches with which and what mixes with which in every individual. That makes it really hard to tell how related two people are just from their nuclear DNA. You can do it. It's a much harder process. If you look at their mitochondrial DNA or their Y chromosome DNA, you can tell right away because that doesn't get mixed up. It doesn't get recombined. You get your father's Y chromosome. He got his father's Y chromosome. The only time that changes is during a mutation. We actually know the rate at which these two things mutate, and because of that, we can make a genetic clock. So we can say, because of my Y chromosome and Troy's Y chromosome, we last shared a male common ancestor at this point based on the amount of mutation differences we have. And we can trace back to literally the last male common ancestor that Troy and I had. We can do that with mitochondrial DNA too. And we've been doing it based on the assumption that you always, 100% of the time, get only your mom's mitochondria. This might throw those calculations off. This is big news. When we talk about mitochondrial Eve or Y chromosome Adam, which is the last female and male ancestors respectively that the human race had, we're doing that based on a mitochondrial clock, which assumes no male input of mitochondrial DNA. This could throw off our estimates of our genetic relatedness based on mitochondrial DNA. This is really big in terms of genetics and human evolution.
So my grandfather now has even more reason to be disappointed in that 23andMe test.
Yes.
This isn't even accurate.
Yeah, I mean, we calculate mitochondrial Eve, I think at like 120K, the last female ancestor that we all shared, and Adam, I think at 90K. But maybe, and the story has always been, of course that's the way it is, because a single male can take over the genetic population much easier than a single female, because a single male can have almost unlimited amount of kids, and a single female can only have a set amount. So that would make sense. But maybe some of that discrepancy is actually due to mistakes in what we assumed was a constant rate of mitochondrial not only passing on, but mutation.
It's always really important to keep in mind what assumptions you're relying on when you're doing these calculations. Yeah. And so, you know, the assumption was that, oh, you're just getting 100% of your DNA from your mom. But bio is so messy. There are so few things that are just, you know, it's always like this and it's clean cut and dry. And we are finding out more and more, like we used to just think it was just DNA making you. And now epigenetics is this whole big thing. And even in my PhD research, I found actually something similar in that it was sort of thought that silent mutations in genes, so it changes a codon in a protein coding sequence.
Like the Charlie Chaplin of mutations.
Not quite.
So it didn't have the Hitler mustache.
But it can change the DNA sequence without changing the protein sequence because there's redundancy in these codons. Mm. And that's often assumed to be neutral. And so you see these slowly build up as species diverge. And people use that as a genetic clock in sort of similar ways to mitochondria. And then in my research, I found I was doing cross-species gene swaps and seeing a number of these silent mutations occurring in these swap genes. And it turns out it was targeting the mRNA secondary structure for destabilization, so the ribosome could read through and make more protein from it. And so it's this, you know, convoluted mechanism that if you're just thinking on a sort of basic bio level, you wouldn't think of that happening. But the bio is always so messy. You got to keep these things in mind.
Yeah, and you know, who knows? Maybe this is so rare. Because again, I don't want to make it seem like now we suddenly discovered we're getting our mitochondrial DNA from our fathers. Again, this is so insanely rare that throughout the history of biology, we have just discovered this. And we've only discovered it in a select small group of related people.
Could this be because dads are taking up more of the domestic responsibility?
That's it.
Mom's going to work.
This is like the dad taking care of the baby. That's right. Yeah, and so this is still incredibly rare. So maybe in the grand scheme of things, it doesn't mean anything to our mitochondrial clocks. But we need to start calculating it. And I don't know how you calculate it because you first have to get the percentage of people this affects before you can calculate how to do this with the clocks.
I think it is likely to be super rare because the results seem to imply there's almost a two-part mechanism needed, where one, you need to not have the male mitochondria get destroyed, and two, it has to have a way to amplify itself preferentially in comparison to the mom's, because even if it just stuck around, the egg is so much larger.
Yes.
It's not going to have anywhere near 74% male mitochondrial DNA, which is what was found in one of these cases.
And so, it's not going to have the mechanisms by which to incorporate that mitochondria into it. Like, I imagine there's probably plenty of times where the tail doesn't detach all the way, and it's just the tail goes in there, and then it's not like all of a sudden that mitochondria is going to jump into the place of the mother's mitochondria. So how does it even happen?
Are those the kids who are born with tails?
Yes, that's exactly what happens. If you are born with a tail, that's why.
You heard it here.
Very, very interesting stuff. Super neat. Again, this came out last week, kind of right before we started recording, and I mentioned it briefly on air, and this was so new and exciting that I really wanted to wait for follow-up studies, and I'm glad I did, because since then they actually came out with some of the numbers and some of the stuff that helps you understand it. Very, very neat stuff that might kind of not only impact the way we think about biology, but how we do certain genetic testing.
Not even testing. It might also have implications for disease, because there are mitochondrial diseases, and a couple years ago, the first three-parent baby was made that you guys probably talked about.
It was because there was going to be a mitochondrial disease passed on, and they did it to avoid that.
Exactly. And so now the results of this maybe imply if there's a mother with a mitochondrial defect and we figure out what are the mechanisms behind this paternal mitochondrial DNA actually getting passed on, we might figure out how to target that and just induce it intentionally.
Yeah. So this could be the equivalent of CRISPR. You know, you find CRISPR naturally occurring in bacteria as their way to protect themselves against phages. And then instead, you take that out and you use that for gene editing. Maybe we find this as a mistake, a way for this, either the woman or the man, to incorporate their mitochondrial DNA into the next generation. And we use that to avoid mitochondrial diseases in the future.
And it would be so much cheaper and easier and less ethically questionable than three-parent babies. So it would be a game changer for mitochondrial disease.
Yeah. And, as we talked about last week, it's always nice when nature does the work for you, right? So if they already figured out how to do it.
Like when God aborts a kid so you don't have to.
Yes. God's Planned Parenthood is way more busy than the other Planned Parenthoods.
Take a ticket. We'll get to you when we can.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Troy, for coming back for 282. And thank you, audience, for coming back where you learned about the origin of mammals, how getting sick as a child might make you crazy, and an amazing new discovery about the possibility of mitochondrial DNA being passed from father to child. Thank you so much for joining us, and come on back this Thursday for Science Faction 283.
Hey, baby, I'm gonna bang you so hard our kids will inherit my mitochondrial DNA. Oh!
You've been listening to Science Faction. Wait, that's not right.